As a disclaimer, this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and the materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content on this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice from any medical condition they have, and they should seek the assistance of their healthcare professional from any such conditions. Everybody, welcome to Red Carpet Healthcare Solutions Private Practice Podcasters. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Molly, along with my co-host,
Travis Bazell.
And today, we've got a really, really cool guest. He's coming from Texas, so definitely the furthest in-person guest that we've had on our show thus far. Most of them have been virtual, so you'll notice a little different setup. We don't have the nice stone wall behind us, but just allowed for the camera angles and everything to work out a little bit better. So without further ado, Marty Nichols.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This has been a...
Thanks for traveling up to see us.
Yep.
All the way from Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas, or as we refer to it as East L.A. and I'd like to start, first of all, with a quick thank you and stuff. I mean, this has been such a wonderful experience. The night last night at the hotel, which is just a beautiful facility, the people that you introduced me to, and it's just so refreshing to sit around a table with people that are like-minded, that are looking to make positive improvements into healthcare, not just about the money, but how do we make it about the patient, make it the overall experience, you know, a better experience. And then this morning, I got to say, this was probably one of the greatest surprises to me, because when I pulled up your clinic, my partner and I were talking as I was up there, and he said, yeah, that's got to be quite a machine or quite a mill. And I was expecting something quite different than the experience that I had today. And I even took a selfie of myself walking in with your building in the background and stuff. And you'd sent me the email saying, hey, you know, make sure you touch with Allison so she's ready for you when you get there. And I didn't see that. I drove up. It was already in the deal. So when I walked in that door, nobody knew who I was. And it was one of the greatest experiences I've had in the healthcare industry with this thing. The lady from the cafe didn't wait for somebody to walk up to the counter. She greeted me when I walked in. How are you doing? If you'd like a cup of coffee, you'd like this. The lady behind the desk, you know, welcome. The experience when you walk into there with your sculpture and the warmth of what you've invited, it just felt more like a spa than something industrial, which is what I was kind of expecting. And I think we tend to forget some of this stuff. Like when you walk into your OR, you do 6 to 10 of these procedures every time you walk in, right? As a representative, when I walked in, I do 6 to 10. For us, it's common. We're comfortable with it. And we sometimes forget that these patients, they're hurting. It's painful and it's scary. It's the first time that they've done it. And that experience, what you've created there, is calming. You know, you've proven the fact that to be efficient, you don't have to be cold. And everybody from the time I walked in, as I walked through the halls, people were busy, people were efficient, but they smiled. They stuck their hand out. How are you doing? They didn't know who I was or what this was. And kudos to you guys. That was just an absolutely beautiful and a wonderful experience. You should be very proud of what you've done there.
Yeah, thank you for acknowledging that. I mean, it's been years of kind of my dream kind of all finally coming to fruition several years back when I built the office. But I mean, you said several times what my main goal was and my mantra when designing, creating, building not only the physical practice, but the infrastructure with the team was experience, right? Yep. Like I used a lot of people from other industries that were successful business owners, particularly Walt Disney. And to me, it was, you go to Walt Disney World for the experience, like nothing other. And I wanted that same feel when patients walked in. They were like, what is this place, right? Didn't feel like your cold, sterile medical office facility. It has warmth. It has dimension. And as Travis has mentioned several times, it's very much me. And now you've been in my house, so you can kind of see the same thing. I like a lot of the natural elements with stone and wood and things like that. But yeah, thank you for acknowledging that. That means a lot.
Yeah, and kudos to your staff. You've done a great job.
Yeah, well, I mean, Travis has helped me a ton with that, along with Sean McKinnon, my business manager. They lead up our leadership team. They meet every Wednesday. So actually, when he kind of broke away, him and Sean, they went and they had a leadership meeting with our leadership team, and then that all trickles down to the staff. So it's been an investment. I hired a leadership coach about a year and a half ago.
Probably 2 years now at this point.
Yeah. Almost 2 years ago. And she actually now lives in Savannah, Georgia. She was from Erie, Pennsylvania, moved down there. Her name's Allison Parplasha. I've given her lots of shout outs over the years, but to me, it's an investment, right? I invest in my staff. I invest in my team. I invest in the building, the practice, and you need to invest in your leaders too and make sure that, you know, we're meeting regularly. And I've kind of pulled myself out of that. Now, ultimately, they kind of bring me into the fold, and Travis and Sean will give me weekly updates, if not more often than weekly, usually daily updates. And but it gives me a little bit of insulation too, as opposed to having to be right there.
I took a lot of notes, and hopefully this is some of the experience that we can capture with what we're trying to do, you know, with our experience and with the financial institute that I'm doing as well too. We hope that when the people come to us and when we get this completed, that's the warmth that they feel when they do business with us.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, I think just sort of a, you know, you acknowledging, you know, just kind of your experience, and then obviously, you know, Dr. Molly's, you know, eventual goal is it's about the team. It's about the experience. And, you know, if the people from a day-to-day perspective, you know, don't have that warmth or, you know, have that joy or have that passion for what they're doing, you don't feel that, right? I mean, there's a genuinity about it that, you know, you're here to help somebody make their day a little bit better, and understanding, you know, patients are there because, man, they don't feel good, right? I mean, my hip, my whatever it might be, it's like, you don't want to make this person's day worse by being kind of rude or off-putting to them. It's about the experience. And I mean, Ryan, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, from the beginning of this whole thing, I mean, and I think that really is kind of the, you know, the difference on a day-to-day basis is kind of what you experienced.
Yep.
So Marty, as we start with all of our guests, you know, I think our viewers really want to know, who is Marty Nichols, right? They may see you on LinkedIn or read some posts, or they see your name attached to weird things such as Physicians First Bancorp, but who is Marty Nichols? Kind of where are you from? The 30,000 foot kind of Cliff Notes version of, you know, where you grew up, your family, and your background in the industry, because you've been in orthopedics for decades. Right?
I tease people all the time, I'm 160 in orthopedic years. I've been this for about 34 years. And what's interesting is I came from a family-owned manufacturing company. My father manufactured livestock restraining equipment in the Midwest and in Iowa. And then I kind of went into the building world of it. And by happenstance, I built a building for a guy that was a distributor for DePue. And we became really good friends. And he kept saying, you should get in medical device sales. And I said, I don't like blood and I don't like needles. And he finally got me to come in and spend a day in surgery, where I was really afraid I was going to pass out. I didn't think I'd get through the day and whatnot. And I got so involved in watching, you know, what they did, and realized in some aspects it was kind of some glorified carpentry work. But the thing that really hit me the most was I spent 2 days with them. And back in that time, if you were under 65, you just didn't get a total joint, right? So we were doing these elderly people. And the second case we did was a hip, and they were doing an AML hip stem that they had to pound down. And it was this 84-year-old lady. And I remember watching that hammer fly, and I thought, oh my gosh, what are we doing to this deal? So when I came back the second day for surgery, when the doctor went around, I asked if I could follow. And when we walked into that room, I mean, I fully expected her to throw the flower vase or something at us, you know, and yell. And I remember asking, I said, you know, do you not hurt, you know? And she looked at me and she said, oh, I hurt, but it's a better pain. And that's what hooked me to orthopedics. Once that happened, I realized, man, this is amazing, because what we just put you through, if you feel better, you know, this is something that's really intriguing to me, right? So I was blessed, and not all physicians are easy to work for, and hospitals and everything else has been tough, but I've been blessed to help provide, to have physicians invite me into that care and be able to provide that. So I spent my career doing this. I started out with a DePew, and then they became a really big company with Johnson & Johnson, and I shifted focus and tried to move to some of the smaller companies. I believe you do some stuff with Medacta and some of the other ones. So I started looking more towards working with companies that were trying to impact, trying to make an improvement, trying to make things better, and I spent a lot of time with them. And I've had a very good life. And along the way, all the way through the career, I watched as we told physicians, as we cut their reimbursements every single year and gave them less and less money to do a better and better job, that they could make it up in volume. And very quickly, I realized we're just going to run out of day. There's only so many hours in the day, you know, to get this thing done, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I think we're there. I think that's what part of what you're trying to address is, I want to do the best job I can with people, but can I now challenge that and maybe do a better job for those people? And unfortunately, the industry doesn't allow you to get paid for being different or being better.
Yeah. I mean, you've hit so many nails on the head here. Travis and I have spoken at length about this, both privately, but also publicly on the podcast, because I think that the American healthcare, the community, right? The patients, the people that are signing up for these insurance plans, they have such a warped view of what medicine really is. Yeah, they all think that physicians are drastically overpaid, and that we make, you know, tens of thousands of dollars for every, just for what I do, a joint replacement. And, you know, the reality of it is like you said, each year we get paid less. Yep. I don't know any jobs on planet Earth that take pay cuts every year, that there's none really, other than I think what I do and several of my colleagues do. And you have to do more and more every year, not just volume wise, but more for each case, right? Getting insurance authorizations. It is an absolute battle. I mean, I've seen numbers, you know, 20 some years ago, you would get paid $8,000 to do a joint replacement. And people think, well, that went to the doctor. It didn't go to the doctor. It went to the practice. The practice had to distribute that to help cover their overhead, to help pay for, you know, their staff, their healthcare benefits, the x-ray machines, the mortgage, the this, the that. You know, overheads are soaring, right, over the past several years. And today, our healthcare reimbursement's just a little over $1,000 for the same operation that we did 20 years ago.
Gross.
But we do it way better.
Yes.
Yeah, gross. So then I got to pay all those same people. So at the end of the day, your surgeon may make a couple hundred dollars to do your joint replacement. It's absurd.
A 94% success rate survivorship at 20 years. You know, if our cars lasted that long, GM would be broke,
right?
And all these other people. We do this. And now we add PROMs into this, you know, to where we're checking the patient's status and outcome, and they've never been higher. And all of this innovation has been driven by the physician, mostly fought by the hospitals and the insurance companies. When I got into this, we kept patients for 10 days, 14 days after a surgery. The doctors got $5,000, a little over $5,000 a procedure, but they got it paid the next day to round on that patient.
Yeah. And when
when we went from 14 to 10, the hospitals said, heresy, you know, you're going to hurt that patient. You know, you can't send that patient home, you know, in 10 days. And the doctors did it. They kept pushing, and we kept coming down and down because the doctors realized more cases than not, the longer the patient was in the hospital, the poorer the outcome was, the better chance of an infection. Yeah. You're around sick people. You're around these other things. Then we hit that magic window of the 3 day. And I don't know if you guys, you're probably
during my training, it was all 3 days, right?
And the hospitals put in their feet and deals. Sure. They dug in tooth and claw to fight doctors on that. And it's interesting that it was the moratorium on physicians being able to own hospitals that actually broke that 3 day barrier, because they had to move them to the outpatient, you know, to do it. And it wasn't, the hospital's concern was never for the patient. Medicare gave them a big ding. They lost money in their mind, and it wasn't really even lose money. They just didn't collect as much money if you sent that patient home quicker than 3 days.
Right.
So all the innovations that have made this so much of a better procedure have all been driven by the very people that the industry, hospitals, manufacturers, insurance companies have crucified, which is the doctors. And that's why we've got such a wonderful procedure that we have today.
Well, I mean, I think the biggest common misconception among amongst most people. I mean, so you have two sides, right? You have, you know, people who hold insurance as consumers, and then, you know, on the physician or, you know, the healthcare side. So it's healthcare and health insurance are not synonymous. They're not the same thing.
So, Did you read Daniel Paul's post today?
But it's so true. And, you know, the more you think about it, the more these conversations have, you know, started to kind of ferment over, you know, years years of us talking about this. But it's like, they're not the same thing. Healthcare is the care that a physician provides to you, right? So that's the surgery, that's the injection, that's the care that you provide, right? Mm-hmm. But what doesn't match up with that is on the health insurance side, right? Right. And so this is where people get confused with, but I have insurance, so you should... No. That's not the way that works, because all things created equal, they're not, right? Well, and so that's the challenge.
The insurance company actually makes money by not providing care. They're more profitable if they don't actually provide it. So, you know, and we'll kind of segue into where this is going. I was sat in on a financial meeting. I started looking at medicine less about a device and about the business of medicine. I really started to focus on that. And I heard a guy do a talk one day, and it just really hit home, and it also helped drive what I'm doing today. Was he talked about the difference between being rich and being wealthy. And physicians, the system is structured such that physicians can be rich, because rich is in the moment. Rich is the money that you earn for work. Wealth is something that can transcend a generation, that can be passed off and moved on. And when you look at it, a doctor, most of the American public think that physicians live well because of how much they're paid. But the reality is, physicians live well because of how hard they work. And Stark laws won't allow physicians to keep ownership. You build a surgery center, you build a hospital with this thing and a practice, and then when you go to retire, they force you to sell it. You don't get to take that, you know, into your retirement, right? You're as rich as you, as hard as you want to work is what determines how rich you are. And that's a price that it pays on your family. In one of your other podcasts, I think you talked a lot about the suicide rate when you were talking with Dr. Paul.
Yeah, I mentioned that quite a bit. I mean, so first and foremost, I need to make sure that if there's any patients out there, anybody, you can be healthcare providers too. My goal is not to make a lot of money, right? That is the result that comes along with providing excellent care and excellent experiences and keeping people safe and out of trouble, right? That's not the focus. And I feel like when people focus on that, it fails. It's always going to fail. You get caught off on these tangents and your focus gets taken off of the meaning of why we went into medical school, which was to help people and to provide care to people. So that's point number one. But we wonder why these physicians are killing themselves. Again, number one suicide rate in the United States is physicians. And amongst physician suicides, the number one subspecialty is orthopedic surgeons. Yep. It's almost a third. It's 28.2%. That's astounding. And you say, well, why, right? Orthopedic surgeons, they tend to like their jobs, they this, they that. But what patients don't realize and what a lot of the public doesn't realize is every single year, the pressure, right? My staff, they don't realize it. They don't understand the business side of things. And they think, I need to make more money every year because I've been here more every year. They don't realize that everybody at that practice is the only people that are making less money every year are the physicians, because we have to continue, especially in the private practice model, have to provide more and more out of our own pockets so that people can get their productivity bonuses, people continue to have their healthcare insurance, people continue to get their annual raises. I mean, it's a recipe for disaster.
We talked about this briefly in your clinic and stuff today too. This is something else that people don't appreciate and understand about the physician. The average orthopedic surgeon in the United States has 8 to 10 full-time employees, right? So not only are they
per physician.
Yeah. So not only are physicians, orthopedic surgeons, providing care to patients, they're providing jobs. And those 8 to 10, those are direct. That's in your office. That's the x-ray tech you have to have. That's the biller, the coder.
The medical systems.
Dr. Paul talked about all that, the medical systems.
Yep.
That doesn't include the lab technicians where you send lab work to. That doesn't include the people that are employed at the hospitals that you come there and do work with and stuff like that. So the pressure that's put on top of a physician, and they tend to be passionate. There's no doubt in my mind, after spending some time in construction and some time in a family-owned business, being a physician is truly a calling. And I think that also helps contribute a little bit to that suicide rate, because they're so passionate about what they do and about providing that care that when they can't achieve the goal they want, that passion overwhelms them and it takes them to a really dark and a very bad place.
Well, it's funny. Just listen to you guys kind of talk about, you know, what was and what is, right? I mean, so he lives right across the street, but my wife's grandfather is 96 and he's Ryan's neighbor, and he was an orthopedic surgeon, you know, and he's 96 now. So you can imagine when he practiced and holidays and things like that. And he knows that, you know, the business that I'm in and, you know, number of surgeons, and just listening to him talk about when he was in practice, you know, back then and what it is now. I mean, almost kind of having that conversation from my perspective now, a couple of years ago, I mean, he flat out just didn't believe me at certain points of the conversation. He's like, yeah, there's just, that's not feasible. And, you know, and it's been a long time since he's practiced, but from what, you know, what used to be then,
you're
and what is
the business side of medicine?
Yeah. I mean, it was private practice then, right? I mean, they had, you know, roles within, you know, hospitals and, you know, they, I mean, essentially it's like, you know, we were talking about community hospitals earlier, but I mean, they had, I mean, all the private physicians within the community, like they helped support and run that hospital, you know? So it was like, and that's not obviously the way that it is now, but from the business perspective, he's just like, I don't know, A, who would want to go into this in the current model. Why would you want to become a doctor in general, right? I mean, it's everything you just talked about. Reimbursements continue to decline. You know, the overhead is not going down. It's only going up. And just the pressure of medicine, right? It's just like, fix me now. Help me today.
And it's
just,
and if it's something doesn't go right, I want to say this, and then I want to get onto the solutions, because that's what this is all about. Healthcare solutions. This isn't a venting session, but when we talk about the pressures of physicians on physicians and providers in general, is, you know, online reviews, right? I recently saw this horrible review of myself, and I know exactly who the patient is. It's like, if you're going to do that, have enough courage to put your name on it. I know what your name is, but when you do that and it gets so personal and attacks my character and my ethics, it's just like, buddy, you have no idea who I am, what I stand for, what I've been through, and how much I put into this. It was the knee was put in wrong. All the angles were wrong. Another doctor told me this. Number one, first rule of thumb is don't bash another physician, because it's karma. It's going to come back to you. But it was just so scathing, and it hurt me at my core, because I'm like, I know this guy. Our relationship early on, he was super nice, and he is just an angry, frustrated person. To his credit, he had a very bad outcome. It's not always, it's not somebody's fault. It's not his fault. It's not my fault. It's, things happen. This is planet Earth.
Yeah.
Right. And that's just one of the other, I think, crosses that we bear. I'm not trying to be a martyr by any means, but it's just the reality of what medicine has become over the years.
Absolutely. So, and to kind of pull this back in, this has been one of the really refreshing things. What we're trying to do now with the Physicians Bank, what we're trying to do.
Yeah, what is this?
Well, so Physicians First Bank, what we realized was, as we watched the transition from hospital-based care to ambulatory surgery center, right? First of all, we were told it couldn't be done. It was unsafe and unhealthy for the patients to try to do these things in a single day. And what we found is it's the greatest thing that ever happened. These patients, because they're now more involved in their physical therapy, they're taking less opioids, you know. I see hospitals, and Andrew Wickline's a good friend of mine, you know, and I was with him one day, and he was reading a published paper, and this hospital bragged that they had their patients to 104 tabs of oxycodone, you know, 104. He's doing them with 10.
Yeah.
He's got his patients, and it hurts him that he's having to give his patients 10. His goal, you know, is to make it even less than that. So it's been really interesting journey is if your reimbursement's getting cut every year, but you have all these people that depend on you, including your patients, and a lifestyle that you deserve and should want, how can we help bring that? So we started looking at it. What we realized, financial institutes, much like large hospitals, have gotten too big, and they try to become everything for everybody. And part of the magic and part of what's made the ASCs work so well is the fact that the physicians were allowed to have an ownership in them. And with that, it focused on MSK, on what you guys do, because now you're back as the captain of the ship. So what happens is the best of the best in MSK want to work in your facility. So when you walk into an OR at a hospital, you could end up with somebody that was scrubbing hearts yesterday, or you could end up with somebody that was doing spine cases, and now you're trying to teach them while you're focusing on the patient. When you walk into your facility, everybody is focused on that patient. Mm-hmm. How do we make this experience the best and the outcome the best? And we learn by allowing the physicians to invest in and have ownership, the staffing becomes better, the focus and alignment goes where it should, towards the patient and towards the outcome. The working environment becomes better, the throughput becomes better, and because of that, the outcomes become better. And very much like what I experienced in your clinic today, and all as I look back in history on all the cases that I did, and as we started trying to become more efficient, tourniquet time. That's what we measured things by, right? And at the end of every case, the doctor sits down and has to put certain things and numbers into a book. And one of the things I noticed was the cases where the doctors were really trying to push that tourniquet time were never the fastest. The fastest tourniquet time was always that case that people just did what they were supposed to do. And the doctor sat down at the end of the case and said, what was the blood loss? You know, they put it in. And what was the tourniquet time? They say 27 minutes. They go, no way, right?
Yeah.
And you look at the tourniquet, it was 27 minutes because people weren't focused on the time, right? They were focused on outcome.
The tasks at hand. The best OR experience for me is I don't really talk during surgery. I'm so laser focused. I put my hand out. The next instrument gets put in my hand. I don't have to ask for it because they know it. Because they've literally done thousands of these, just like myself, right? We're on the same team. We're rowing the boat in the same direction. Yep. And I will tell you guys and girls out there, the best feeling in the world was 2020, right after the COVID shutdown. For the first day when I walked into my own physician-owned hospital, the moratorium obviously has kind of made that few and far between and impossible for new ones to open. Right now, maybe that will change in the future. Hopefully it will. But ASC is the same thing. Is the best feeling I ever had professionally was walking into an institute that I knew I was part of.
Correct.
And I was in line with the administration. I was in line with the staff, which the patients then feel that because you're all working to get to the same common goal.
I mean, think about this. Can we imagine a world where a licensed mechanic couldn't own an auto repair shop, right? Yeah. Or a licensed beautician couldn't own a salon? You know, how did we get to a point where somehow we convinced the American public that a CEO that was trained in profitability and money is rated and paid purely on profitability, has got the patient's interest better in mind than a physician that was trained to actually take care of that patient and provide that care?
Yeah.
So anyway, we looked at a lot of those similarities and the lessons we learned on how good these ASCs have. And we simply looked at the financial institute. And now within our industry, one of the big buzzwords is revenue repair. You know, we're hearing private equity and stuff say, we're going to come in and do revenue repair. And we think we found some of the purest form of it is saying, look, instead of trying to make the doctors more efficient so they can do this three or four more times, instead of trying to take away something from them, how about if we could just provide a better service for something that's necessary? Because like it or not, for you to keep your practice and to have that facility that you have to bank. You need access to capital. You need to have access to money.
Yeah.
And having to take time out of your day to go explain it to somebody that has to also understand agriculture and has to understand, you know, traditional manufacturing and has to understand day-to-day car loans and stuff versus your ability to share your vision with what you're trying to build with a financial partner that already knows and knows where you're trying to go. And that's what we're trying to create. And what's really been impressive to me, and I guess I should have known that this was going to happen, 90% or 80% of the questions I get when I bring this up and I talk to physicians about it isn't about how much money can I make. It's been really interesting. I get questions of, could this help us do, what about patients that necessarily can't afford, you know, care? Or what about this? It's more about
that. How was one of my first questions to you.
right. And you would think that if physicians were purely about the money, their thing would be, okay, how much money, more money can I make?
Yeah.
But most of them even sit down when it's all done and think, you know, it would be kind of nice if I could make a little bit of money for doing something anyway. Maybe I could see one less patient a day and spend an extra 5 minutes with each one of my patients.
Yeah.
Right. Or maybe get a little bit back more of my quality of time. But nobody has came to me, or I haven't had any physician talk to me yet and say, man, this is great. I can't wait for the additional revenue that this is going to generate.
You know? Yeah.
Well, I think the concept's kind of cool too. I mean, just in general, right? You know, in terms of healthcare, whether it's a DME company or whether it's a distributorship or whether it's an orthopedic practice, it's a, you know, a big group of private internists, whatever it might be, to, you know, have a lending entity or really a partner, right? I mean, you absolutely know, more so than, you know, just, you know, the lending side of things is, you know, healthcare is one, is a very interesting business from an accounting perspective, because what you do in January is, in terms of like, okay, your cost, your overhead, is not necessarily the revenue that you capture in January, yeah, right? So like the months never line up, right? So, and deduct, there's all these things that impact, okay, well, what's the trend look like? And you look at it and you're like, ooh, this doesn't look that good. What's going on here? It's a cycle of healthcare,
yeah,
that quite honestly, unless you do it and have done it, you know, for a long time, it's hard to wrap your head around that. So when you're trying to, you know, these special projects, or, you know, you want to open up a private practice, or, you know, you're looking to have a joint venture with somebody, going to, you know, a traditional lending, you know, outfit is like, this doesn't make any sense to us. It's hard to put that kind of puzzle together unless you've done it.
No, and a perfect example of this is, and I'm going to tie back to something you said a minute ago as well too, but right now the trend has been, and we're starting to see the cycle. I just saw there was a paper published in JAMA, and what it said was that 30% of the physicians that are in academia, mm-hmm, right now want out. They're trying to, yeah, come back. So we're watching that cycle, right? It used to be when we went to the medical meetings, at every medical meeting, some physician from the podium would ask the room, how many of you are private practice? And the majority of the hands went up, right? And then the next question was, how many of you are employed by the hospital? And it was a fewer number of hands for a period of time, right? And then the question was, how many of you believe that in the next 3 to 5 years, you will have to become an employee just to practice medicine? And overwhelmingly, the hands went up, right? And now this is starting to circle back around. And as we meet on this journey with the bank, as we meet with these young residents and fellows, and we talk to them and they're hospital employed, 70 to 75% of them in the conversation with us, when we ask why hospital employment over private practice, universally say, if I could have afforded to buy into the ancillaries, to buy into your surgical hospital, to buy into the imaging and stuff, I would have preferred to go to private practice. But I just got out of school. I've got no previous work history, right? My debt is astronomically high. On average, you're looking, you know, if you're a fellowship trained surgeon, you're looking at carrying $400,000 in student debt.
Yeah.
You know, it's debt alone. So they're actually being forced to go into a practice or an employment situation that they would prefer not to, but simply because the banks don't understand. And what's interesting is the financial institutes that won't loan that fellow or resident the money to buy into the ancillaries, which would greatly enhance their revenue stream in their first year, is the same financial institute that will loan them $90,000 for their first SUV, which is going to depreciate from the day they drive it off, right, of the lot.
Exactly.
But the traditional bank understands that tangible asset, and they understand that doctors are very good at paying back loans. So we believe that ultimately by having this financial institute, we can help healthcare from that aspect as well too. We can help physicians find their way to private practice. And again, one of the byproducts of your surgical hospital and of the ambulatory surgery centers is, what's interesting is all these things that the people are saying that doctors will drive up the cost have been proven false.
Absolutely.
The outcomes at an ambulatory surgery center are better and the costs are lower. And so this is why now all of a sudden, 5 years ago, you couldn't get an insurance company to write a contract with an ambulatory surgery center. And now they're coming to it. They're starting to look at this and saying, hey, maybe we need to relook at where this is. And so hopefully with the financial institute, we can help change that. And I'd like to tie one other thing. You made the
I just want to tie back into young residents, fellows coming out and first jobs, right? Yeah. Because I think there's a couple other reasons that they do that. Number one, I think it's more attractive from an initial lucrative perspective, mm-hmm, right? Because most of the, I went out into private practice right out of fellowship. Marty, my starting salary at the private practice was $150,000, right? To the average person, that sounds like a ton of money. But yeah, for an orthopedic surgeon, that
carrying $400,000 in debt, student loan alone.
So it's not. But so they see that big paycheck, right? But it comes with the golden handcuffs. Mm-hmm. So once they get into the system and they're in the hospital employed system, it's very difficult to get out. And if you're going to get out, you're moving, and you're moving your whole family, because your non-compete zone is so wide, so impactful for at least a year, that they essentially make you relocate, and you got to start all over again. And no one wants to start all over again ever. But when it happens, they tend to unfortunately repeat history and go to the next hospital employed position because it's easier, right? It's more of a 9-to-5 job. There's not the headaches of owning the business, but there's also not the freedom that comes with the private practice, which is you can do things the way you want to do them. But yeah, I mean, I think the Physicians First Bank idea is, it makes so much sense from so many different perspectives. When we first started talking about this, I didn't quite think about the fact that most bankers have to be kind of like used to talking to different industries. You mentioned agriculture. You mentioned, you know, maybe your auto mechanic, manufacturer, whatever it may be. And they're probably least educated on the medical side of things.
Absolutely. And because it's so strange. And I'd like to tie back to something Travis said, you know, your father-in-law across the street, right? You said he wouldn't really recognize medicine, you know, understand Dr. Molly's practice today. The same is true with banking, and that's one of the things that we can capitalize on. And part of the challenge that the traditional banks have, and maybe even some of the traditional hospitals, is they are so invested in what they have. So the traditional bank comes into a community and they buy a nice building downtown to put their name up on, and that's where a lot of the business is downtown.
Right.
But then their customers live, and in my case in Austin, Texas, they moved to Dripping Springs. So the bank has to build branch banks in Dripping Springs, and they have to put full-time employees in, they have to put equipment in there, and they have to put security with it. And then people move to Round Rock. So then they have to have a branch bank in Round Rock. And then they move to where I live, which is in Leander or Cedar Park. And it's a very dated way to do business. The truth is, branch banks don't really provide any relationship. You pull up to the window, you know, you put the deal on the deal, you talk through a speaker, half the time you can't hear, right? And this is something that the big banks right now, they can't get rid of that because they have so much invested in it. And one of the unique things about the medical industry and the medical world is we don't deal and transact in cash. All the money moves electronically and moves on the wire. So what we're able to do is to capitalize off of today's modern technology. And what we hope to create is by being able to take a single small brick and mortar, you know, so you've got your traditional bank, but build off of it a concierge level software that creates the experience like I had in your place today, to where with software today, we can create a scenario where you have a delay in a surgery or a something canceled, but you had some banking you need to do. In today's world, you can't leave that hospital because they're prepping the next patient and getting the next deal ready. And you can't drive down to the bank. And most banks open at 9 o'clock in the morning and close at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So how does the traditional physician even bank? And what we can do with software today is create a scenario where you have a personal banker, you have a personal teller. You're not just taking a picture of a check with your phone, but you have that 30-minute break, and it could be something as simple as you guys are looking at a new car, you know, and stuff. You touch a button and you connect to a banker that knows you, knows your business, understands it, understands your revenue, and you can say, hey, look, I've got 30 minutes here, 20 minutes while I'm waiting for a case, but we're looking at a new car. And the banker knows, you say, great, what are you looking at? You know, what model? You tell them. What interest rate are they offering you? You tell them, and they say, okay, we can probably beat that by 0.25% because we don't have all that other overhead, right? And we don't have to say, okay, pull together 2 years of your tax returns, you know, give me all the ownership papers for your deal, because we know it, right? So now you, within a matter of 15 or 20 minutes, had the experience of walking into a bank without disrupting your care of your patients or your clinic. This can be done from home in the evening.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big things that we can transition different, because the industry's changed, or the technology has changed at a rate with this that the industry can't accept the current status quo.
that's interesting to me. So I guess the one thing that I guess I've always known, but something that you just said that resonated with me is like concierge is convenience.
Yeah.
The convenience of being able to get all of the things that you want accomplished without having to go through, you know, I've got to get in my car. I've got to drive down there. I got to talk to this person who I don't really know. Right. It just happens to be whoever's in at the time. And then I've got to get this. We need 2 years. It's like, okay. This is going to take 3-4 days for me to go through all that. You've condensed that entire process into 15-20 minutes because it's more of a partnership, more of a relationship, not so much just a transactional thing.
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, with Physicians First Bank, are you going to have different branches like the business side and the personal side, or is it all kind of
business and personal does all the same because you'll have a personal banker.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that we've also started to do with this is we realized it was a really interesting conversation I had with the CEO of one of the really large groups, you know, and in our original business model, one of the things that we didn't want is that golden handcuff. So specifically written into our model and plan is we won't allow for an entity right now to own the stock. What we didn't want to do is have ABC Orthopedic Group buy up a handful of shares and then offers an incentive to their doctors' shares as an incentive, because that would then become golden handcuffs that, well, if you want to leave employment from us, you don't get to take that stock with you, right? Mm-hmm. You don't get that wealth. You're rich while you're working for us, but you can't have wealth. You can't take it with you, right?
So I guess my kind of stupid question of the day would be, how does one start a bank?
Yeah, that's been a
I don't think that's a stupid question at all.
Like. Marty goes, hold on, honey. Let me get in my checkbook. Let me write this out.
And I'll tie in something kind of funny with all that. That's a really interesting deal because I didn't know much about it either, and it's been a journey. So the first thing you got to do is you got to surround yourself with smart people that do that, right? You know, and that entailed getting a legal team and everything else and then sitting down and meeting with them. And that's also one of the reasons there was a lot of talk to us. People say, well, why are you buying a small bank? Why don't you just build a new bank? Well, the FDIC is charged with not only regulating banks, but they insure the deposits. So it's real important for them that you're doing good loans and that you're taking good deposits, because people deposit money into a bank. And then what the bank does is they lend against those deposits. Well, if you're not doing a good job of lending and you have a bunch of bad loans, you could lose people's deposits, and then the FDIC insures them and they come out. So what the FDIC would rather see is America's kind of unique. There's literally countries that only have 4 banks in the entire country. And if you look at the Treasury Department, you look at the big 6 banks in the world, the United States, they would like to see that consolidation, right? Sure. You know, JP Morgan like to see all of these little ones go away. Interestingly enough, people often ask, why does the FDIC only have a $250,000 cap? You know, why will they only let me insure? That's their way of trying to drive competition. What their hope is that you have to then bank with multiple little small banks so that the industry can't consolidate huge bank.
That makes sense.
So part of the reason, or part of how do you go about this is you have to sit down. We had to sit down with lawyers. We had to sit down with accountants. We sat down with the banking commissioners. We sat down with the FDIC. We've had multiple meetings with the Federal Reserve. We talked to them about our plan, you know, what it is that we want to do and how we want to go about it and how we're going to accomplish it, right? And then they've literally worked with us, and the attorneys and the CPAs then helped us build the business plan, wrote how are we going to do this, how is this going to work. And then we've presented it back to different people within those organizations, and they look at it and they say, okay. And they're not going to tell you, just like the FDA, if you go to get something approved, they're not going to say, yeah, this isn't going to get approved, or yeah, you know, we'll improve that.
Sounds a lot like a tax bill.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
Write the number down. I'll let you know if it's enough.
Right. And it's been really, they've been really good people to work with, because more or less what they do is they say, look, I think you might want to look and examine at this.
Yeah.
So literally my partner and I spent 2.5 years and money out of our pocket with lawyers, with the CPAs, writing the business plan and modeling it out. And that's where we got to just a little about almost a year ago.
When did you start this whole process?
We started it. The concept, the idea of it really started about almost a decade ago. But literally what happened was in 2019, my partner ran into a very scenario where he and two of his colleagues wanted to buy an urgent care. Had an opportunity to buy an urgent care, for an orthopedic surgeon to own an urgent care makes sense, mm-hmm. right? Goes to the deal. And they sat down, and the gentleman that wanted to sell it to him wanted a 2.5 year runway and was going to stay on, and they were going to borrow X amount of money and then pay him out, and then he was going to transition out, and then they would have the business, and they would also have his expertise. They couldn't find a financial institute to write them the loan, because of the 11 urgent cares in the market, five of them were in properties that the gentleman owned. They were in buildings that he physically owned, but the other six were leased. And the traditional banker couldn't understand that. What they were saying is, well, what happens if I loan you money and you lose your lease? You know, because they see buildings, but they've never really understood medicine as charts, right? If you find a better office, we've all seen the restaurant that was in the little narrow place, and it was hip, cool, and trendy, and people were lined out the door forever. And then they finally decide, you know what? We found a building over here, 2 miles away, and it's much bigger, and then it fails.
Mm-hmm.
It loses the ambience, you know, and whatnot, and it goes sure. away.
Yeah.
But when you get the little postcard in the mail from your doctor saying, hey, we're moving our office, your first thought isn't, crud, I got to find a new doctor. Your first thought is you're looking at the map saying, is it closer to my home
right.
or is it further away?
Right.
Right? So because of that, physicians have never traditionally didn't want the distraction of ownership. They were happy to lease because you were focused on taking care of the patient. And this is the thing I get a kick out of. The industry and all these people have told us that healthcare is expensive because doctors traditionally aren't good business people. And then we force them towards being business people, right? You know, we're literally, by cutting their reimbursements, we're making you do this. And so as the physicians have moved from two people groups, and in your father-in-law's case, you know, he was probably solo or maybe three or four surgeons at most in a group. And they did it mostly the reasons that physicians were in a group before was because for the privilege of practicing medicine, you have to take call at the hospital, right? So most doctors, if you looked at them, the reason for a four-man group, you know, or a six-person group was
sharing that
call. Right? Yep. So that meant that every weekend you were on call. So a four-man group meant you only had to take call one weekend a month, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't about making more money like big companies. Big companies consolidate to make more money.
Yeah. Right?
Doctors did it just for quality of life.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're going on vacation, you want to have someone there that can help to take care of your patients while you're gone, and so that you can hopefully unplug. But I hope you're going into that story that you mentioned to me about the business side of why physicians are historically bad business people. But it's almost like because we were never exposed to it, I think intentionally.
We didn't want doctors, and we shouldn't. This was the thing. When all of this started happening, and I watched this transition, I was telling people, careful what you wish for, right? Because good business states that if it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and back then, you had pagers. We didn't have the luxury of the cell phones and stuff. And you might argue a cell phone might not be a luxury anymore. It's allowed people not plan.
Yeah.
But when your pager goes off at 2 o'clock in the morning, and it's a motor vehicle accident with alcohol involved and no insurance, right? You know right away that you're not going to get paid to get out of bed and go in there. And what's even worse, if you go back and look at it statistically, 60% or greater of the lawsuits that come against a physician were from patients that didn't pay. So if you want a doctor to be good business would say when that pager goes off at 2 o'clock and it's a motor vehicle accident and there's alcohol and drugs involved, set the pager back down. You wouldn't go in.
Right.
Right. And I caution people, if you want doctors to be good business people, they have always represented the upper 5th percentile in intelligence. Their focus was on the patient. And listen to even some of the stuff we've just had in this conversation. Even in this conversation, you always take it back to the patient, right? And this is something that the American public should wake up and realize, and why physicians should own the hospital, why you want the physician to own more of this. And the reality of it is insurance companies, hospitals, manufacturers will always look at healthcare from the revenue down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Value-based care is a perfect example. We've been chasing BPCI and we've been chasing this value-based care. And look at how flawed it is. What they basically say is, okay, here's a pool of money that we spent last year to take care of X number of patients. And any money that you can save, you can have. It's basically saying deny care or push something out or don't provide something you provided before so you can make more money. And that's just a fool's game,
right?
You know, in the whole deal. The truth of the matter is, if you're the CEO of a hospital and you're bonused on the profitability of the hospital, and you have a patient that may or may not be able to pay or has some sort of struggles and problems, you don't care because you're looking at your role or your profitability, your P&L statement. If you allow the physician to own the hospital, they're going to get their professional fee anyway. So if they have to discount the facility fee by 10% or 12%, they are far more apt to do that. And that's one of the reasons that we've seen, if you look at where the savings have come by moving things to the ambulatory surgery centers, the professional fees stayed the same.
Yeah.
But what you guys are willing to do is become more efficient and take a little less of the profit from the surgery center, and the outcomes improved.
Yeah.
In all statistical data, the outcomes in the physician-owned facilities.
Complications go down. I mean,
yeah,
it's been proven time and time and time again. But
yep.
When insurance companies are now allowed to start owning hospitals, that's where it starts to get really ugly and muddy.
And right? Hospitals own insurance companies. Look at, you know, Kaiser, you know, you've got Intermountain Health Corporation, Baylor Scott & White. You know, you look at the consolidation in Texas, they're real prevalent and stuff down there. Well, Scott & White was actually an insurance provider. They had hospitals and they provide. And Baylor comes in with a huge amount of money and buys them. And now all of a sudden you look, you got a Baylor here and a Scott & White here. And now you got Baylor, Scott & White. What they bought was they wanted access to the insurance. So the hospitals started going into the insurance company. And think of this. You get paid better with your insurance. And we've had a lot of discussion over the last day and a half about insurance and can you get in it? Could you get out of it? You know, and what do you do with it? But you get paid the best if you're in network and it's the least amount of trouble for your staff, but it's still a huge amount of trouble just to do the billing and everything else if you are quote unquote in network.
Correct.
Okay. So by in network, that means that you've got a contract with that hospital or with that insurance provider that they believe you can provide the care that they took money from a patient to provide, right? Why then is there pre-authorization?
Exactly.
If somebody's sitting in a cubicle that's never touched the patient, never seen the patient, has no history of the patient, and no or little or no medical training at all, has to pre-authorize you. And if you ask them, they'll say, well, we do that because that surgeons don't do unnecessary surgery. Well, shouldn't the answer be if you're quote unquote in network and you're needing pre-authorization because you're doing rogue surgery, shouldn't they just simply cut you from the network?
Absolutely.
Don't they have right. that obligation?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good point.
But again, these people that are making these decisions or then you do a peer-to-peer because they deny it, right?
Correct.
And I think peer-to-peer is a very loose term, right? You're talking with somebody that's probably never done, say, a total knee replacement or a total hip replacement or whatever it may be, but they're talking to you as though they're the expert on this.
What's interesting is there's two lawsuits going right now that peer-to-peer was a bot.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was a chat GPT, and there's now a suit going because these insurance companies were using AI, and they were feeding information, and an AI was sending back the answer. Your peer wasn't even a medically trained doctor.
Well, it's crazy. I mean, I told this story, I think, in the last two podcasts. I don't know how long I've been dealing with it, but I won't say the insurance company, but that my wife and I carry. She has epilepsy. She has a medication that she needs. Neurologist at the Cleveland Clinic. This is the medication she needs. Everyone's on the same page. Insurance company, whoever it is, they're not a pharmacist, not a neurologist, don't have any pharmacology background, nothing. No feedback at all. She needs to take a generic. Why is that? Well, because it's cheaper. That's why. But, you know, she had breakthrough seizures with it, so she can't. So she has to take the brand, right? It's already been documented. You know, this is trial and error, right? So this is, we didn't even have an option. We had to do that. Wasn't broken, but it's cheaper. So let's go this way. We get all the way to that point. Who's making that decision? I have all the conversations with the physicians, the providers, you know, even from a pharmacy level. And I'm talking to someone about the pre-authorization hasn't been cleared yet. Well, what about the person who doesn't have $1,300 to pay out of pocket for the medication? It's like, so they're just subjected to potentially having a threshold to have a seizure because, well, I mean, who?
But they have insurance, but they don't have the
But no one, but no, you have no clue who you're talking to your point. I mean, you're talking online. Who am I chatting with? Is it a person? Is it a, you know, an ab, whatever it is? And the, but the people that are, you know, enforcing these, you know, almost scripts is in my head how I envision these conversations happening. They're not clinical. They have no, you know, they've got no background knowledge on any of it. It's just essentially they're like henchmen. They're just, there's a directive, you know, okay, force them to here. Okay, here. It's just like, I see the way this chart is, you know, designed and it's like, no, over here. Yes, over. And it's just like, they keep pushing to the power of cheap.
Yeah. And, it's just and like, they think not, that eventually people are just going to give up.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm done. I can't do this
they
anymore.
Do.
Just,
and
they just wear you down.
It's just like, it's, that's not good care. That's not good medicine. And it's like the difference, healthcare, health insurance, the care that we've gotten,
insurance and healthcare,
the care that we've gotten has been fantastic. The neurologists have been great. You know, all of the, you know, various pharmacists that have, you know, educated us on, you know, brand versus generic and why these things happen and that sort of stuff. The healthcare side of it, we've had really good experience. The other side of it, though, and this is where these two get mixed.
Sure.
And that's where the confusion happens. And it has not been a great experience. But, you know, I just, it resonates with me kind of what we're talking about because, I mean, it happens every single day. And it's like,
so what are some of the other solutions for not only issues like that, but just, sure. I mean, the whole theme of this podcast that we started solutions. Was, you know, how can we help provide individuals, medical providers, particularly physicians, that are interested in private practice to continue to succeed? And how can we help swing that pendulum back? Because we know it's only a matter of time, right? Where these hospital-employed physicians are miserable. They're getting very frustrated. They're starting to look, but they're like, how do I do it? I'm so far indebted. I got the golden handcuffs on. Reimbursement's going down. You know, my overhead's going up. Is that even an option? Do I just get out of medicine? Like, what are some of the other solutions that you find?
So this is the other fun aspect of this and stuff. And I'll kind of deviate a little bit, but I think I'll get where you want to go with this. And that is, you know, we go to all these big medical meetings and stuff, and the KOLs all present, you know, all their data and stuff like that. And doctors come in to get CME credits from all over. So back in the old days, you know, when there was money to be made with MRIs, that was one of the big things. Physicians, as they got sophisticated and got into a group, could afford to do these things, so they buy an MRI. Now what happens is Dr. X from rural Nebraska, population, you know, of his community is 7,000, and the draw for a 100-mile radius might be 50,000 people, comes to a medical meeting, and they've reimbursements gotten cut just like everybody else's. And they see Dr. Molly present, you know, well, my group, we bought an MRI, and here's the value we've got from it. We can now control the quality of the scan that we get better. The technicians are trained to know what we want, right? We get a better scan. We get it quicker. Our patients get treated better. And here's how much money I made on this last year, right?
And for the record, I did not buy an MRI.
I understand. But and I just pulled that one out of the deal. You know, so what happens is this doctor from rural Nebraska goes back to his partners and says, hey guys, I was just at this meeting and we need to buy an MRI. These things just print money, right? Mm-hmm. Well, if the company that's financing that makes money selling you that MRI, they're going to say, yeah, you need an MRI. And they're going to sell you $1 million MRI, right? If you go to your banker, they don't know what the MRI does, how it goes to your practice or anything else. We hope and see that by bringing the specialization and aligning things, just like you align things at your hospital, aligned it. Now when you align the financial piece of it as well too, you now have people you can turn to that will look at that and say, yeah, no, look, the doctor that you saw give that presentation, this is their population base and this is their draw. And this is why that $1 million investment makes sense. Here's your population base, right? They don't just say no, denied, you know, they sit down with them and say, look, this just isn't a good investment. But I notice in your books and stuff, it doesn't appear that you guys are doing any form of physical therapy. So as a financial institute, how much space do you have in your building and whatnot? Can we help you maybe build physical therapy that can now provide better care of your patients because, again, you control them. You don't lose them, you know, when they go away. It helps you generate revenue, you know, and control that patient better. They should be able to do things now, you know, that things like imaging equipment, C-arms and ultrasounds is right now. If a bank has to repossess a C-arm, what do they do with it? You know, whereas if we're a financial institute that's aligned and you need a better C-arm for your facility, so you're upgrading one, and then somebody in that rural community in Kansas is looking for one, as a banker, instead of saying, look, don't borrow the full amount and go buy a brand new one from Siemens, we've got one over here and we can get you a better rate. We can finance this and it will more than adequately do what you want. So you have a partner in your financial journey, not somebody that's just profiting from your financial journey.
Yeah. So, one of the things that I'm hearing, and that was the first thing that I thought of, was like, this is a partnership, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and so obviously you have kind of taken it a step further. I mean, you've become a resource Correct. To these people, right? So, you know, and I know just like traditional banking, right? Like we have investments and, you know, we've got, you know, big banks that do that stuff. So, and there's a fee associated with that, right? Mm-hmm. So like becoming a member or a customer of the bank, whether it's a project, it sounds like, I mean, that's a lot, right? Because that's a lot of consulting, tying pieces together, distributorship relationships. Hey, we can help here, help there. Now, this isn't a good idea because here's why. And, you know, by the way, are you doing this? And here's how we can put this together. Is that all in like encompassing of the experience with the bank? Or, yes. I mean, because yeah. this seems just like from your, you know, to have the expertise, I mean, that covers you to make sure you're not, you know, bad lending and, you know, bad partnerships and bad deals from that regard to protect the bank. But I think from a customer perspective, if you were someone who was, you know, looking into one of these projects or wanted to do something like that, I mean, there's a huge value to have, you know, that kind of, you know, relationship and almost the consulting, really. It's kind of like it's included.
There's a reason. Look at how, as medicine has grown and whatnot, and especially go back to your father-in-law mm-hmm. versus Dr. Molly. You know, Dr. Molly's become very specialized and very good at what you do. If you see a bad ankle or ankle fracture, you're not going to do that. You're going to refer it over to the person that does it. Specialties has made sense, right? A spine specialist, because that gets a better outcome. A total joint specialist and everything else. Why is that not true through all professions? So why do you want a banker that you're going in and trying to talk to about your financial journey for your healthcare stuff, that what they really know is manufacturing, or they really know auto loans, or they know stuff like that?
Yeah, why does niche look at attorneys, right? Like each attorney has their own. Correct. There's healthcare attorneys. Correct. There's, you know, real estate attorneys. There's litigators. So yeah, I mean, it totally makes sense. You just think a banker's a banker, right?
Yep.
But and Travis, you bring up a great point. It's a partnership.
It's a partnership.
It truly is a partnership.
What a great idea. I mean, the more and more we talk through it, it's just like, it's such a no-brainer to me.
So I guess.
Thank you.
How do we make this a no-brainer for physicians out there that are looking for this option? How do they get in touch with you? What are your goals? I mean, you've given your kind of talk to me, and I've heard it several times now. That's not the point of this, but like, how do they sign up to maybe do a Zoom call with you?
And sure. So we've actually cleaned up our website to do this. We're just Physicians First Bank Corp. Now, it's not with a K. So the website is just PF Bank Corp, BANCORP. And
Jay can put that right here when he edits okay. the podcast. So that'll be right on the screen.
That'll be nice. I'll send it over to you and stuff. And on that, there's now a page that you can schedule a Zoom call with me.
I saw that. I was looking at that yesterday, actually.
And it's been a little bit of a challenge for me because it's been a new one for me. Technology's gone faster than I am, because I'll be sitting there and somebody will log on at 10 or 9:30 in the morning or schedule a 10 o'clock call, you know. So I haven't done a good job of managing that. And then at the very end,
it's like a Calendly.
Yeah.
Like with Allison Parplasha, where you could just book your time slot, but on your end, you got to make sure that you're
keeping it updated.
Yeah.
That I don't have something else going on. And then we also have all the documents and stuff. Once you decide to go down that journey to look at it and look at it, an investment, it is a personal investment. It's individuals. We struggle a little bit. People want to think that it's a group investment. It's not, but it makes sense. The more from your group that individually invest, the stronger your group's voice is within the entity of the bank. So the more of you that are there, the better the experience will be. So, you know, log on to there, talk to us a little bit about it, get educated on this stuff. I mean, take a look around, look at, and that's the thing that's been amazing to me is there's big different sophistication levels. Like I talked to your scheduler, I got introduced to your scheduler before I left. I was talking to her a little bit about some of the stuff when I brought up the idea of swipe fees. I mean, her eyes lit up right away. She knew exactly what I was talking about and how much of your practice pays just for the privilege of swiping a credit card. So this is kind of a journey to educate. And it's amazing to me as I talk to these physicians and stuff, sometimes their eyes glaze a little bit, but take a little bit of time and just research, look around your practice and your personal life and think about how much you depend on banking and on financials. Yeah. And then think about this. One of the challenges I face because we're a 506C instead of a 506B to invest, you have to have a business manager, a CPA or a banker sign off that you're a quote unquote accredited investor. And it's proven a real challenge. Most of these guys don't meet with their bankers, don't even know who their banker is. They know what name of bank they bank with, but they don't know the name of a banker. They see their CPA once a year, right about now at tax time. And some of them even, you know, do that. And then because your guys' life is so demanding and done during normal business hours, you know, what's normal business hours for a surgeon? It's the spouses of most of the physicians that manage the financial deal and checks. And so one of the things we've actually done is the head of this group, it's a little over 100-person group, he said, look, Marty, I'm a little concerned that in your model you're counting on the individual bank people to switch their banking. And he said, I'm the CEO of a 120-person group. I can move that business, but I'm not the CEO of my home. And that's actually kind of a big win for us. We thought getting the bigger part of the business would be harder to do. So listening to him, and this is the other advantage of being aligned, what we've already started inside is we've put together one of the first advisory groups. The lawyers and stuff are wrapping how we do it legally and do it right. And then as soon as we get close enough to owning the bank, we're going to have the CEO of the bank bring in a focus group of spouses and sit down with them and ask them, you know, what are the top two or three things that you really like about your current financial institute, right? What are the two or three things that your financial institute don't do that they could do better, right? And then the most important question is, what are the one or two things that you would attract you to switch, to move your banking? And because we're a small entity and we're building it instead of buying something big, like a lot of these companies do and trying to assimilate it, we're building it from the ground up. We can take that kind of input. We can sit down with your scheduler and we can talk about how would the software work if we're going to help patients get financing so that instead of not being able, even if they have insurance, but don't have the money for the deductible in January, February, and March, so they're putting off surgical care that they could benefit from till October, November, or December.
Right.
What if we could help those patients through financing and get them the care when they need it, you know, and we'll sit down with them. What would that look like? Who are those patients and how many of those could we fill? And we can take that input and build it into the software. And it's not like a branch bank. I don't have to take it down. If my branch bank's in the wrong location, it's software.
So what's your kind of timeline for when you see this thing potential? I know there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle that have to fall into place. You don't need to go into that detail, but do you have a time frame of when you think this may become a reality?
Yeah, and we're pushing really hard right now. The goal we've set forth is Q1, the end of Q1, to have the finances in place to actually acquire one of the target banks. We're actually got three different banks that we've been talking to. I'm trailing behind it. It's a little aggressive. The challenge with so many of these things is you have to pick a date, right? You got to put it. If I tell people the end of this year, then people will sit and call me in October, November, December and say, okay, how close are you? It's the end of the year now. Come in. So you have to pick a date. We're going to probably miss Q1. I think we can pull this off by the end of Q2 to have the money to actually then acquire the small bank. The bank's up and functioning. It's profitable. We don't want to strip the community of it. So our business model, we're going to leave the community bank in place, and we're going to continue to service that community. Then what we're going to do is we've worked with two companies to integrate this concierge or build this concierge software, and it's there. I can actually do a demo with it. It works. We feel it's going to take us 2 quarters to integrate that software into the community bank to be able to then be a true national platform and stuff. So our goal is by the end of the year to be have the first round of investors in to be providing a value to all the physicians and start the alignment and go.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, we've kind of talked about a lot of stuff, but I mean, how does one even, I mean, how does one approach a bank about buying it?
Yeah, and that's one of the other reasons, you know, a lot of people talk about why the Midwest and why would we do that? Again, I touched on this a little bit earlier.
So, where's the bank based out of?
The ones that we're looking at right now are all three now in Iowa. We're looking at one in Illinois.
Okay.
We chose the Midwest because central time zone. They're a relatively depressed market, so we can hire virtual tellers and people, you know, and provide jobs and stuff for them. The other reality is like I said, there's countries that only have four banks in the whole country, but the United States was unique. We have 4,700 banks in the United States. And across the Midwest, a lot of these were called generational banks. So it was the family bank.
Mm-hmm.
And they were built around ag. So there's a lot of these little banks that are in a community. And it was in the town that I grew up in, town of 8,000, when I was a kid, there was probably 34 farm families. And the consolidation has hit there too. There's four, right? There's four big farmers now that commercially farm all this stuff. So those banks are struggling a little bit. So those are the types of the banks that we're out looking for. And we've had some of them come to us. We've had attorneys that have found the other ones, but we're looking for, and we'll try to acquire that small generational bank. And they can't compete anymore, but that's one of the values we'll bring back to that community is when we stack this new software on the top of it, to be able to do what we're calling the U.S. bank for the physicians, that community bank will then benefit from that upgrade in software. Because there's right now, there's no way that a small bank in a community of 3,000 people is going to have the most convenient newest software. So we'll be able to push that back down, and then we'll be able to provide a better service for that community and actually save a bank. And that's also one of the other reasons the FDIC would prefer you buy an existing charter rather than create a de novo. If you can take a bank that might be stressed or might be challenged and keep it, that's a good win for them too.
I think that's great. Honestly,
I think it's an awesome concept, awesome project. As I've told you, I'm extremely interested, and I'm going to help continue to spread the word, not only through this platform, but I've already contacted you with two of the other physicians at my practice, so. I want to thank you for making the trip up here.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not your last.
I hope not either. I've definitely got to bring my partner back to see your facility. This has been, sometimes you get ready to jump on that plane and it's the quick couple of day trip and subconsciously you kind of groan because traveling kind of isn't the fun that it used to be.
Especially to like Northwestern Pennsylvania, right? This time of year.
Look, this has been one of my better trips. I mean, even the drive, like I said, I drove by Mark Twain's house today. You know, if it had been open, I'd have probably stopped in and stuff. The people you introduced me to last night, I mean, it was a wonderful experience for me. What a neat little community. You're going through your clinic today was just, it's revitalized me. Yeah. I hope that we can, and I believe we can, bring a lot of what you've created with your clinic and with your practice into the banking and strengthen all of our business. I want to give something back to an industry that's been good to me. And yeah, I'm going to make a little money doing it, I hope. You know, nobody wants to work for free.
Should.
But yeah, but you know, but this is the spirit I found. Most physicians I've worked with, the money's always been secondary. Money always takes care of itself if you do the right thing and work. And there's not many industries left that you can say that about. And so hopefully we put this all together. We have some fun. Hopefully I get to make another trip back up here. Maybe we can do another podcast.
Absolutely.
Maybe that'd be nice. You know,
maybe the next time we'll do it a little later in the evening, you know, because, you know, maybe we can have a glass of wine or something like that.
Yeah. So. Celebrate a little bit once this thing's off the ground. So, Marty.
Love it.
Thanks again.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
So for all of our viewers out there, again, subscribe, push that button. It's easy. Share it with your friends. Share it with your colleagues. If you have any other interesting guests that you think would be great on our show, we're always, you know, open, welcome to those suggestions. You can email us. You can comment on our YouTube or any of our other channels. And, I just want to thank you guys for tuning in. And
awesome.
Thanks.
Yeah, Marty, thank you so much. Travels, yeah, appreciate it.
What else, Trav?
No, that's it. Like Dr. Molly said, any guests, anyone that you can think of, you know, maybe in the healthcare space or in a community that you'd like to see on with Dr. Molly and I, drop us a link, let us know. Any topics that you're interested in, anything like that, we're pretty open. So,
Yeah, we've got some great guests coming up.
Yep.
I mean, we've got healthcare attorneys coming on. We're going to talk about concierge medicine with one of my best friends and college roommates. And we just want to keep it open, keep it fresh, and keep contributing and providing good content. That's really our goal here. So
good stuff coming.
Yep. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll catch you next week. Take care.
Thanks.